Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
So we are going to start tonight in Leviticus 19. There are only 27 chapters in the book of Leviticus. So we are working our way toward the end here. But we are going to read all the way through chapter 19 because it really has just so many different little rules packed together. Chapter 20 then picks up where chapter 18 left off and walks through all of the restrictions that we read last week and talks about the attendant punishments that were required for anybody who was guilty of all the stuff we read last week. But in between the rules of last week and the punishments of chapter 20, there's chapter 19 and just a whole lot of various and sundry rules. Chapter 19, however, I'm going to take slightly out of order, and I want to start with verse 32. Not because it seems self-serving, but I have to tell you a story that will tie into this. Besides, look around the room. Everyone here is going to agree.
They can hardly wait.
Exactly. This past Saturday, this church building was packed to the gills with people for Simeon Priestcorn's 13th birthday observance, wingding shindig. And I haven't used the word shindig since the 1960s. It was a very cool thing because what Len does with his kids, this is only his second child now that has reached the age of 13, but since they homeschool, they don't get the big graduation party when they graduate high school. And since they start into pre-collegiate classes in their junior and senior year of their homeschooling, they just sort of transition from there into college. And so there's no big graduation like kids get when they go to public school. And so Simeon had his 13th birthday party observance thing here in the church. And he had relatives in and friends in, and they packed this place. And what Len does with his boys is that it's sort of a coming of age, though Len's very clear to explain to everybody that it's not about age of accountability or any of that, which is completely non-biblical. But it's an opportunity to kind of recognize that the young man is becoming a teenager now and taking on greater responsibilities as he's growing older. And one of the things that they did with Simeon after he had an opportunity to play a song on the piano and recite a poem that he had memorized, then he had several men, uncles, grandparents, speak to him and give him bits of advice. And I was asked if I would also give Simeon a bit of advice. But as the day got longer, Len turned to me and said, "Would you mind if we forewent that and you just go ahead and do the prayer and we'll just move?" And I said, "Sure, I'm fine with that," which means I never had the opportunity to make my statement, which I am now going to pass on to all of you. Verse 32 of Leviticus 19 says, "You will rise up before the gray-headed." And that means stand up, show respect to people who have lived long enough to have gray hair. Bald head counts. I just thought Laurel stood up. "And you will honor the aged, and you shall revere your God." That, by the way, just put the aged in a really good group. Gray-headed, aged, and God. Pay attention to them all, and revere God, and honor the aged, which is a concept that is disappearing in the very youth-oriented society in which we live. Even growing up as I did in the 60s and 70s, there was a phrase, "Don't trust anyone over 40. Rock bands like The Who saying, "I hope I die before I get old," because being old was just a bad thing. But biblically, being old is a really good thing. And let me tell you why? Because if you've lived a while, you know some stuff. And you know some stuff that young people don't know yet because they haven't lived long enough. My advice to Simeon was going to be, pay attention when old people talk to you, because they've actually been there and done that, and they can save you a lot of trouble. People who have already been there can tell you how to avoid the pain and the struggles in life. The great irony is that young people, especially young men, full of testosterone, are convinced that they already know everything. And they're convinced that they already rule the world. And that they don't need anybody's advice about anything. They're going to do it their own way. They're going to show you. Some of the most vociferous emails that I get are from young men in their 20s who have reached the point where they finally know it all. And they're going to tell that old preacher a couple of things. When I read these emails and replies from young men, I can't help but just kind of smile and read through it and just kind of chuckle, because I know something they don't know. I know what it's like to be 50, and I know what it's like to be 20. They only know what it's like to be 20, which means they don't know yet that when they get to 50, they'll look back on what they were like when they were 20 and think, how foolish I was, how silly I was, how full of myself I was. You don't know this because you're sitting up front, but all the people behind you are nodding. Because they all know that it's true, that age gives you perspective that you can't get when you're young and you're full of steam and you're just out there trying to conquer the world on your own. I had a pencil drawing that a friend of mine gave me when I was living in Los Angeles and I was pursuing my first record deal. And it was a wonderful pencil drawing in phenomenal detail of buildings on top of buildings on top of buildings and high rises and skyscrapers full of windows and windows and windows and windows and cars and cars and cars and buses and trains and planes and people and everything. And out of one little window in the far distance, there was one little face in the little window with a little thought bubble. And he was saying, someday I'm going to own this town. And that's the way all us young men are. We look out on the world and go, someday I'm going to conquer. I am going to take over this world or this town or this city or something. I'm going to live and conquer. And the older you get, the less important that seems. And the more things like human relationships become important. The more you recognize the value of the people you love and, more importantly, the people who love you. And the more you listen to people who have already been through the struggles, if you'll pay attention to them, they can tell you where the ditches are and where the potholes are and how to avoid them. Now, something else us men that are in our 50s know about young men is that you're not going to listen to us. We will tell you to listen to us. We will tell you that we can save you a lot of trouble if you'll just listen to us. But you're hardwired to go, you're old, what do you know? I've got strength and I'm young and I have vim and vigor and testosterone and I can do whatever I want. I don't need to listen to old people. But the Bible throughout, especially in a verse like this, says, pay attention to the old people. Because even if they can't do what you can do anymore, they know stuff you don't know. And the only way you're going to know it is to live as long as them. And so my wish for Simeon was going to be that God would give him long enough life that he would reach my age. Because I had 40 years on him. He was 13. I'm 53. I wanted him to gain another 40 years so that he'd be able to look back on the day that he was 13 and a 53-year-old man said to him, listen, just pay attention. One thing young men are not good at is listening. They're really, really good at charging forward. When I reached 50, I learned a lot about myself and life and the key element of what I was missing in my whole life. And I pass this on to you young people yet again. One word, and the word is think. I realized when I hit 50 that I had spent the vast majority of my life reacting. Listen to all the people going, yep, yeah, yeah. Stuff happened, I would react. Stuff happens, I react. How seldom in my life I would stop and think. Is this a good move? Is this the right move right now? Is this going to advance me in a direction I ought to go? So seldom I ever considered those things. Now it's part of my daily routine, partly because I prefer to sit now. But I stop and I just think. I plan, I consider, I count the cost. And it occurred to me, the more I did that, how seldom I did that as a young man, and how much easier my life would have been. I had access to one of the most brilliant men in the world, my dad, who had done so many things in his life, been so many places, endured such hardship, and had so many amazing victories in his life. And once he was gone, and I realized I couldn't talk to him anymore, it occurred to me how many questions I still had, how many things I still needed to ask him. Because whenever I needed to know something like, how do I turn the pilot on my furnace when I became a homeowner for the first time? I'd call my dad. Dad, what kind of lawnmower should I get? Dad, you know, how do they install carpet? Dad, my drain is leaking. Dad, this woman is going to make me crazy. Dad, call your dad. You call your dad. Dad, dad. I had access to this very smart man. And then I reached my middle 20s and had a record deal and thought I was going to go conquer the world. And there was a long period there where I just didn't really talk to Dad because I thought I had the world by the tail. And then Dad was gone. And that's when I realized I had access for all those years to a brilliant man. And I didn't bother to talk to him. And I should have. Well, the Bible says repeatedly over and over and over again, young people, pay attention and reverence in an appropriate way old people, because they are a repository of the stuff of life. People who hit 70 didn't do that by mistake. They did that through hard-headed endurance. They got through every day, day by day, and they are a repository of knowledge now. And yet, you can see an old person walking by you in the mall and just think, that's an old guy. The older I've gotten, the more I look at them and think, how'd he get that old? What must he know? What has he seen? What has he lived through? I remember talking to my grandmother one time, and she was talking about when she didn't have a telephone. Nobody had a telephone. Telephone? Nobody had a telephone. Forget internet or computers. I mean, my grandmother never touched one of those. She talked about the first time she ever saw an airplane, how wonderful it was. When my grandmother died, she had never learned to drive because my grandfather had always driven her everywhere. Things have changed so dramatically, and those people worked so hard to get through a day and to make their living and to get their bread. Now, think in those terms when you read this. God talking to the children of Israel. And every day they get up and they have two primary needs, something to wear, something to eat. Now, the folks who have been around for a while, by now, by the time you hit Mount Sinai, the older men, the gray men, they have endured slavery in Egypt and lived to gray hair. These guys knew something. They knew how to endure. They knew how to trust God. They knew how to get through a day. The young men, you know, could get up every day and run around and go wild and chase girls, but if they didn't find something to eat, something to drink, and something to wear, they didn't make it through another day. And so it was always going to be the older people who were going to show them how, show them the way, show them how to get through another day, teach them how to think, teach them how to prioritize. So I never got to say to young Simeon Priestcorn, you're surrounded in this church by people who have been through things you can't imagine. People who remember the days before TV. The days when a good night's entertainment was when you would sit and talk to each other before everybody went to a separate room and sat in front of their monitor screen and texted friends instead. So take advantage of it. Take advantage of the people who are around you who have this wealth of knowledge, because the older I get, the more I realize that those people won't always be here. And you learn to appreciate them once you can't get to them anymore. So appreciate them while they're here. And I think that's what lays at the heart of this verse that says, stand up when a gray-haired person comes in. I mean, stand up and show them appropriate respect instead of the way modern America treats old people, which is just to shuffle them off in a corner or corral them into old people's homes and ignore them. I mean, our government right now, not to get political on you, but the sweep in government right now is toward younger, more youth, more. Obama today gave Queen Elizabeth an iPod. And she already had one. Like she couldn't have one if she wanted it. But do you see the trend? Mm-hmm. When a head of state can give something like an iPod, that's trending to youth, trending to youth, trending to youth. And there is in America right now still this great resource of people who have lived, who remember the world wars, who remember Korea, well, at least World War II, let's say, who remember Korea, who remember Vietnam, who remember the Great Depression. My grandfather lived through the Great Depression. His stories of the Great Depression were fascinating, what they had to go through to survive. And so now we are so spoiled that we think that this downturn in the economy is the worst depression since the... Well, no, it's not. No, it's not. We've had longer, worse downturns in the last 30 years than what we're enduring right now. But the trend toward youth is, this must be terrible because I, as a young person, have never encountered this before. Therefore, this is awful for me, which is why it's so important that the people who haven't gone through these things before talk to the people who have, because the people who have done it know how to get through it. And we are ignoring those people in favor of the notions of the young who have no idea what they're doing. Well, there's my political statement for the evening. But apply that to life, because every once in a while, you young people, you're going to run into events in life where you have the opportunity to charge forward or to think. And the best way to think is to talk to somebody who's already done that enough times to be able to say to you, well, here are your options. And as my daughter is sick of hearing me say, and as my son could recite to you at a moment's notice, most of the time, the right thing to do and the hardest thing to do, yeah, they are the exact same thing. And it helps to have somebody tell you, yeah, that's going to be hard to do, but it's the right thing to do. And boy, the amount of trouble you can save yourself when you do the next right thing. But if you just leave it up to your own inexperience, you'll go charging forward and just keep getting hit in the head over and over and over and over and over again. So we started there tonight so that I could backtrack to what I wanted to say to Simeon, which was, listen, think, and pay attention to older folks. They actually do know what they're talking about. So you shall rise up before the gray-headed and honor the aged, and you shall revere your God. I am the Lord. Now go to verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, now I have to frame this because this is a fascinating piece of the book of Leviticus. We've just gone from all the real moral laws about sexuality and who you can have sex with and who you can't and all the stuff that we dealt with last week, big, heavy stuff. Then the subject matter does now start to change, and there is a quick review of some of the Ten Commandments. Now, I know you're sick and tired of hearing this, but I have to frame it. There are folk out there who will tell you that the law of Moses can be divided into three categories of law. That there is the moral law, and they will usually tell you that the moral law is summarized in the Ten Commandments. That the Ten Commandments constitute the moral law of God. And therefore, being the moral law of God, one segment of the overall law, that the moral law of God is for all time and all people in all places. That's the moral law. It doesn't change. It started at Eden. It'll go on forever. The moral law of God doesn't change. And then they'll say there is a civil law as part of the law of Moses. And they'll say there is a ceremonial law. They'll say the civil law are good ideas that continue into most good civil societies, and then that the religious laws, the ceremonial laws, are done away within the new covenant. So by making those distinctions, they're able to say this part of the law no longer applies, like animal sacrifice or the priesthood, because those are ceremonial laws given to Israel that no longer apply. But the moral law, especially the Ten Commandments, continues throughout time. Okay, now I challenge you to prove that from what we're going to read now in chapter 19. Because chapter 19 begins with, "Speak to all the congregation of the sons of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord, your God, am holy." He's going to remind them repeatedly through these rules. I am your God. I am a holy God. Be holy. What that means is be consecrated, be separate, don't be like the world. It worries some people and upsets them when they read that, be holy because I am holy, and they think, well, God is absolutely holy and sinless. I am absolutely wretched and sinful. In what way can I possibly be holy like God is holy? What he's saying to Israel here is, I'm separate, be separate. I'm consecrated, I am not of the world, so you be consecrated to me and not of the world. So that is their inspiration to follow all these rules. I am God and I am different. I am God and I am separate. I am not like the world is not like me. Therefore, since I have chosen you out of the world, be separate. Every one of you shall reverence his mother and his father. I would like to stand here for a moment. Never mind. Does that sound familiar? Every one of you shall reverence his mother and his father. Does that sound familiar? Uh-huh. Where does that come from?
The Ten Commandments.
Ten Commandments. Which one, by the way?
No.
Which one, by the way? The fifth. If you kept guessing, you were going to hit it. 3, 5, 9, 7, 2, 8, 12. It's the 12th commandment. It is. It's the fifth commandment. It's one of the Ten Commandments. So if we're dividing the law up into categories, what category are we in right now?
Moral.
We're in the moral rules right now. And just to really make it clear we're in the moral rules right now, he says, honor your mother and your father, and you shall keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God. Which commandment is keep the Sabbath?
Four.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the fourth commandment. So we're clearly in the Ten Commandments now, aren't we? We're clearly repeating Ten Commandments. We're clearly in the moral law. Do not turn to idols or make for yourself molten gods. I am the Lord your God. Which commandment is that? The second one, the second commandment. So we're clearly in the ten here. Now, when you offer a sacrifice of peace offerings to the Lord, you shall offer it so that you may be accepted. What just happened?
We switched
to what?
Ceremonial.
Suddenly we're in the ceremonial law, aren't we?
Flip-flopping.
We're flip-flopping here, yeah. But look at verse 11. You shall not steal or deal falsely or lie to one another. Which one is thou shalt not steal?
Seven.
The eighth commandment is thou shalt not steal. Which one is don't bear false witness?
Nine.
So verses 2, 3, and 4, you're in the moral law, Ten Commandment territory. Verse 11, you're back into the Ten Commandment moral law territory. Verses 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 are into the ceremonial rules. And then in verse 9, it's going to go to, now when you reap a harvest of your land, leave the sides open. It's a civil rule. So we went moral Ten Commandments into a brief foray into ceremonial rules, followed up by a civil rule closed off with another moral Ten Commandments rule. And when Moses said them, he just wrote them all down in order, packed them all together, and said, here's your law. Where in the text, forget theories of how to divide up the law, forget philosophical or theological presuppositions, where in the text do you find moral, civil, ceremonial divisions in chapter 19 between verses 1 and 13? Do those divisions exist? No, they don't exist. They're not there. They're not in the text anywhere. And that's why I've said repeatedly, it's real easy to speak of the law theoretically and say, now, in theory, the law can be divided up into these three categories. It's only when you read the law in detail that you recognize that it's impossible to divide it up that way, because Moses does this all the time, where he jumps between categories and crams them together. And there's simply nothing in the text that would allow you to delineate between them and say, now this one's good, this one's continually good, this one's good as long as there's a civil society in which it can be good, and this one stopped when the new covenant came into being. There's no way to do that in the context of what's written here. So I insist repeatedly over and over that the law of Moses, the law at Mount Sinai, is a whole, an undivided whole. You have to accept it as a whole, the way that it was imposed on Israel as a whole. And if you were guilty of any one of these rules, then you were guilty of all the law, whether that was trimming the side of your beard, or whether that was gleaning the edges of your land, or whether that was not honoring your mother or your father. Any one of those rules was enough to make you a lawbreaker. And that's why I insist that the new covenant is qualitatively new, because the whole of the old covenant stands or falls as a group. You understand me? Okay. Yes, now.
I think I made an error. I think 7 wasn't thou shalt not steal. I think it was the 8th commandment.
Yes, the 8th commandment is thou shalt not steal. Why? Roller skates. Very good. Okay, now we can move on. Did that make sense to anybody? I taught my children the Ten Commandments by teaching them a mnemonic device, a memory device. You want to do it?
Sure.
Yeah, it'll take like 5 minutes, and then you will be able to recite the Ten Commandments backwards or forwards and out of order, which is usually very difficult. You can say to somebody, 5th one, and they'll know. Tell somebody, 7th one, they'll know. You ready? You want to do this?
Yeah.
You either have to want to do it as a group. First, we have to have some coat hangers, some pegs that we can hang these commandments on. And so we're going to go 1 through 10, and we're going to create some real quick hooks that we can hook the commandments onto. Close your eyes. Trust me on this one. Close your eyes. Okay. Number 1, I want you to see a great big number 1. See a great big number 1 in front of you? Okay, it's a tree. Make that number 1 into a tree. You see that great big tall standing up tree, number 1? Great. Number 2 is a light switch. Up or down? 1, 2, 1, 2, light switch. Up and down. Got it? Okay. Number 3 is a three-legged stool. 3 legs on the stool. It's a rickety stool. It's got 3 legs. It kind of rattles. It kind of shakes. What's number 1?
Tree.
What's number 3?
Stool. Rickety stool.
What's number 2? Two is a light switch. 3 is a stool.
Oh.
Okay. I went out of order on purpose. Okay, number 4. Close your eyes. Number 4 is a car. Number 4 is a car, 4 wheels. It has 4 wheels. It's a car. It's got 4 wheels. Okay? Let's see. Number 5 is a glove that goes on your hand. It is a glove. Okay? Number 6 is a gun. It's a 6-shooter. 6-shooter. It's a gun. 6-shooter. Okay, what's number 4?
Car.
Car. Okay. What's number 2?
Light switch.
Okay. What's number 1?
Tree.
Okay. What's number 5?
Glove.
What's number 6?
Six shooter.
Gun. Yeah. What's number 4?
Car.
What's number 3?
Stool.
Okay. Number 7 is dice, because the most common number on a pair of dice is a 7. And so 7 is dice. Got it? Mm-hmm. Okay, number 8 is roller skates, because they have 8 wheels, 4 on each foot. So eight is roller skates. Look at the number eight. Think about having skates on and skating in a figure eight. Skating in a figure eight. Okay, what's number seven?
Dice.
Sure, what's number five?
Glove.
Good. What's number two?
Light switch.
Good. What's number one?
Tree.
What's number six?
Six shooter.
What's five?
Glove.
What's seven?
Dice.
Yeah, what's number eight?
Skates.
Okay, now, I have to stop. Marilyn, don't try to remember them, try to visualize them. If you try to remember them, it's harder. And that's why I said close your eyes. If you visualize the eight and then visualize yourself roller skating in an eight, then every time you say eight, roller skating will come back. If you visualize one as a tree, then every time you say one, you'll see the tree, right? So visualize it. Don't try to memorize it. It's two different things. Okay, number nine in our household, number nine is a cat, primarily because cats have nine lives. So nine is a cat, okay? So what's seven?
Dice.
Yeah, so what's four?
Car.
Yeah. What's five?
Glove.
What's one?
Tree.
What's three?
Stool.
Okay, 10 is bowling pins, because there's 10 bowling pins. So 10 is bowling pins. So I want you to visualize the 10 in your head, but then on the 10, see bowling pins standing up, 10 bowling pins. And the bigger you make the image in your head, not just bowling pins standing there, but think of bowling pins and now the bowling ball hitting the bowling pins, and you can hear that sound and the crash of the pins. The bigger you make the image, the quicker it'll come back to you. And this is all based on the premise that we think in pictures. We don't think in words. You think in images. Even if I say the word elephant, you don't think E-L-E-P-H. You picture an elephant. You think in pictures. And so we're just creating pictures for those 10 numbers because that'll help you remember the numbers quicker. Okay? Okay, so God is one. One is God. Number one, one is God. God makes trees. You'll have no other God before me. When you think of number one, think of a tree. Think of God who made the tree. Look at the heavens. Look behind the tree at the blue sky. And there's God. He's the only God. Number one, you'll have no other gods before me. Number two is a light switch. You're in a dark room. It's completely dark. And when you turn it on, oh no, it is full of graves. The room that you're standing in is full of... Close your eyes and picture it. The room you're in is full of graves, and coming up out of the graves are golden idols. Golden idols coming up out of the graves because you turn that light switch on. Turn that light switch back off so you don't have to see them anymore. Turn that light switch on. There are open graves because graven images come out of them. Oh, by the way, what's number one?
Tree.
It's a tree because it's God. You'll have no other gods before me. Okay, so what's number two?
Light switch.
Yeah, it's a light switch. When you turn it on, there's graven images. Yeah. Number three is a rickety stool. And so you're sitting on that rickety stool and you're about to fall off. You're about to fall off. Oh, no, and you say a dirty word. Oh, you're falling off. You say, oh, don't turn. Don't take the Lord's name in vain. Oh, Marilyn just got it. So, okay, you're on that rickety stool. It falls over. Oh, you're upset by it. And so don't take the Lord's name in vain. Number four is a car. You get in the car to go to church. That was the way my children remembered it. You get in the car so that you can go to church. And so we use that as remember the Sabbath day, because where are you going? You're going to church. Why are you going to church? Well, Sabbath day. Forget the fact, the Saturday, Sunday thing. Don't get theological, just remember. Five is a glove, and this one was a little tougher because James had a game called Glover that he used. But think of the glove, picture the glove, and now picture the glove reaching out and touching your mother's face, and then reaching out and patting your father on the head. You're using your hand and your glove to reach out to your parents. What is three?
Stool
falling over, which means what?
Don't take the
Lord's name in vain. What's number one?
Tree.
No other God.
Yeah, so what's number two?
Light switch. Graven images.
Yeah, light switch.
What is
there's
no graven images.
Right, and graven image means an image that you've made or that you've constructed, that you've engraved is where that word comes from.
What
so
is the actual, like, wording?
Yeah, thou shalt make no graven images. So that's why I made graves with images coming out of them. Yeah. Number six is a gun. Anybody got to figure that one out? Don't kill. Yeah, six shooter, gun, don't kill. Number seven is dice.
Don't steal.
Because dice are played where?
At a casino,
gambling, Las Vegas. And at Las Vegas, there are showgirls, and you start looking around, you're going, oh no, showgirls, temptation, oh no, don't commit adultery. Yep. See how quickly that connection got made? Everybody went, oh yeah, dice, oh look around, sugar, oh don't commit adultery. Okay, that was easy. Eight Eight is roller skates. This is why you have to imagine it. This is why you have to picture it. And the more you picture it, the quicker it'll come back to you. Imagine that you've put roller skates on at the roller rink, and then you've skated out the front door with them. You've taken them, and you're skating down the street with them. You've taken off with your roller skates. Yeah, thou shalt not steal. Right? Mm-hmm. You've skated off with your skates. Okay, so what's number five?
Honor your father and mother.
It's a glove. Honor your father and your mother. Yeah, he got it right away. You didn't know the Ten Commandments by number when you got here, did you?
No.
And you're knocking them off now. What's number two?
Graven images.
Yeah. What's number one?
Tree. No other gods before me.
Yeah. What's the sixth commandment?
Six. Do not kill.
Yeah.
Gun. Yeah.
Gun. Don't kill. Yeah. And if you practice these on your way home tonight, you and Izzy practice on the way home?
We'll quiz each other.
Next thing you know, you'll have them. You'll just, people will say,
that's cool. Right before you
fourth commandment?
This, I was hoping that you would do something.
Oh, good. Fourth commandment?
Sabbath.
Exactly, because you're in the cars, you drive, and it's the Sabbath, yeah. Eighth commandment?
Dice.
Eighth commandment?
Thou shalt not steal.
Roller skates, don't steal. Seventh commandment?
Dice.
Don't commit adultery.
Don't commit adultery. Yeah, now the ninth commandment, this only works in my house because we live with cats. And one thing that we know about cats is that cats lie. And and in our house, that's especially true. So when I was teaching my kids this way of remembering the Ten Commandments, we use nine lies, cats, and cats lie. And the ninth commandment is don't bear false witness. You would have to live with cats for a while to know that cats will lie to you. So yeah, you have to trust me on the cats lying thing. But think of cats, and then think of cats going, rawr, 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 I'm hungry, I want to go out. Rawr, 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 rawr. See? See, it worked. But we'll see that they tell lies. Cats will just talk to you and tell you stuff that isn't true. I want to go out. You open the door, they lay down. I don't, what? I need food. You fill their bowl, they walk away. See? Cats lie. Okay, you got that one now. See, that's stuck in your head now. Tenth one is bowling pins. Bowling pins and somebody who had an absolutely beautiful marble see-through bowling ball that had like this beautiful sparkle fleck in it and everything, and you could see it rolling down there and hitting the pins, and you would think, that is a beautiful bowling ball. I would love to have one of those. Well, it's don't covet, of course, is the tenth one. And so you start longing for that great bowling ball, and you say, oh, that's a great ball. By the way, what's the sixth commandment?
Don't kill.
Yeah. Okay, now, you guys already know them, so hang on for a second, because you walk through the door not knowing them, right? So this is your quiz now. Okay, this is your quiz. Use your skills. We might check with Marilyn.
No, we won't.
What's the seventh commandment?
Die. And do not commit adultery.
Right, exactly. What's the first commandment?
No other gods before me.
What's the third commandment?
Don't take the Lord's name in vain.
Yeah, what's the fifth commandment?
Honor your father and mother.
And what's the fourth commandment?
Keep the Sabbath.
Right. What's the seventh commandment?
Do not commit adultery.
Right. What's the sixth commandment?
Don't kill.
What's the tenth commandment?
Don't covet.
Yeah. What's the ninth commandment?
Don't lie.
Don't lie. Don't bear false witness. What's the second commandment?
No graven images.
Yeah. What's the third commandment?
Don't take the Lord's name in vain.
What's the fourth commandment?
Keep the Sabbath.
What's the fifth commandment?
Honor your father and mother.
What's your sixth commandment?
Don't kill.
What's the seventh commandment?
Don't commit adultery.
What's the eighth commandment?
Don't steal.
What's the ninth commandment?
Don't lie.
What's the tenth commandment?
The bowling ball. Don't covet the bowling ball.
Don't covet the bowling ball. There you go. Kellen, ladies and gentlemen. But I digress. I was in Franklin teaching Sunday school to teenagers the first time I came up with that. They enjoyed it so much that I then constructed a similar story that I taught them all, and they memorized the story forward and backwards because it had particular images in it. And what they didn't know is at the end of the hour when they had memorized the story, they had memorized all the books of the New Testament. And their parents, I challenged the parents then when church started, I said, go to your kid and name any book in the New Testament and they'll tell you the book ahead of it and the book behind it. And every kid in the class could do it because mnemonic devices like that work really, really well. So if you practice that for a day or two, it'll be there forever. It'll just be stuck in your head. So practice that.
Thanks.
So much for the digression. So my point in chapter 19 so far is that it begins with references to Ten Commandments. Then it's going to move into what can only be called a religious law, starting in verse 5. Now when you offer a sacrifice of peace offerings to the Lord, you shall offer it so that you may be accepted. It shall be eaten the same day you offer it, and the next day, but what remains until the third day shall be burned with fire. Now that's a rule we've already heard. Earlier in this same book, he already laid out that rule, but now he's reminding them again, because repetition is the key to learning. And so God lays out rules and then goes back and says them again and again. So if it is eaten at all on the third day, it is an offense and it will not be accepted. Verse 8, and everyone who eats it will bear his iniquity, for he has profaned the holy thing of the Lord. And that person shall be cut off from his people. Doesn't that seem like a very extreme punishment for eating food on the third day? So if you bring a peace offering to God and you take it to the tent of meeting, it'll be killed in the doorway by the priest, and then you can eat it, and you can eat it the day it was killed, and you can eat it the day after. But if you eat it the third day, you're cut off from your people. Is that strictly just a health rule? Does God just want to make sure that you don't eat meat that's laid around for 2 days? Or does it have to do with, as all these rules do, honoring God and God saying, you'll be different and you'll do things my way. These are the rules. And he can be as broad as what we saw last week. Don't have sex with animals. And we would all go, yeah, we agree with that rule completely. Yes, don't have sex with your mother. Yes, I'm totally with that rule. Don't eat meat from a sacrifice on the third day. Why? And God says, because I said so. These are my rules. Why 1 day out of seven? Why 1 day out of seven would you do no work at all?
Because you said so.
Yeah. Pardon me?
He rested on the seventh day.
And because he rested on the seventh day. But why did he rest on the seventh day? Did he need to?
No.
Was he tired?
No.
He was finished. He was finished, yeah.
It's the one section of time that doesn't have a natural phenomenon to mark it.
Isn't that interesting? And so God just kind of said, this is the way we're going to do things. Now, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, neither shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest, nor shall you glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather the fallen fruit of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the needy and for the stranger. I am the Lord your God. Now, what that means is when you're out there doing your harvest, some of that grain is going to fall to the ground. So he says, don't harvest all the way out to the corners of your land. Leave the corners. And the grain that falls, just let it fall. Let it stay on the ground. Now, that plays a real important role in a later book of the Old Testament, the book of Ruth. And Ruth goes into a field by a guy named Boaz, who it's going to turn out is her near kinsman redeemer. We're going to get into the redeeming rules as we continue here through the law. But there were rules that said if an Israelite was given property by God, once they come into the promised land and every family and every tribe was given property, that property remained with that family in perpetuity. And if you had to sell the property, if you lost the property through debt, or through borrowing, and so you had to sell the property, God had a timetable set where every 50 years, every seven sevens, so there'd be a seventh year Sabbath, and after the seventh year Sabbath, the next year was what was called the year of Jubilees. And on the year of Jubilees, which was every 50th year, everything in Israel went back to its original owner, so that everything remained where God put it. So when God said, this land belongs to Ephraim, that land always belonged to Ephraim. And if some family or tribe of Ephraim ended up losing the land, or if they sold the land, in fact, we're going to see that in the upcoming chapter, that if they were to sell that land or even sell themselves into bondage for a debt that they couldn't pay, in making the deal to figure out what the price was, You had to count the years to the Jubilee and then prorate the price based on that. Because come the 50th year, if you were an Israelite servant, you were free. And if you owned land, you got your land back. And so one of the things that you could do if you had lost your inheritance and you couldn't redeem it back, or if you were an Israelite who went into bondage to a stranger in Israel, you could be redeemed back out by a near kinsman, which meant somebody who was in your family, who was near of kin. If he had the price, if he had sufficient price to pay, he could pay to redeem your land or even redeem you out of your debt and out of your slavery, out of your servitude. And so that's what the book of Ruth teaches. It teaches that near kinsman rule because Ruth was told by Naomi, her mother-in-law, that she did have a near kinsman even though she had lost her inheritance. And so there was this Boaz. And so she went down to the field of Boaz, and not only were there people gleaning in the fields, the poor and the widows and the fatherless were down there, and the strangers were down there getting the grain that had been left behind. But there's a wonderful phrase in the book of Ruth where Boaz tells his servants when he sees Ruth to drop some handfuls on purpose. And so I've heard some wonderful sermons in my life called Handfuls of Purpose, because that's the way the King James reads, is drop some handfuls of purpose. And that's what God does, just goes along dropping on purpose, leaving behind for us and for all those for whom he provides. Well, it turns out that Boaz finds out that Ruth is his near kinsman, and so he does marry her. But before he can marry her and redeem her and get her property, there is a nearer kinsman that has to be dealt with. And that's actually a very funny story. You'll have to go home and read it yourself, because Boaz goes to him and says, "Will you redeem the land?" And he says, "Well, yeah, the land. Yeah, I'm interested in that, the land." And he goes, "Okay, but the woman comes with it." And he goes, "No, I'm good." So he takes off his shoe and gives it to Boaz, a sign that he doesn't want to do the redeeming thing. And so the near kinsman who has the sufficient price marries her and redeems her and redeems her land so that she doesn't lose her inheritance. Well, the reason for that whole thing being written into the Old Testament is that Jesus is called our elder brother so that he becomes our near kinsman. He becomes our closest kinsman, and we have lost our inheritance. And we have lost our rights and sold ourselves into slavery to sin. And so our near kinsman, who actually has the price, sufficient price to pay to buy us off of our slavery and redeem our inheritance. One other thing about the near kinsman that was very important that's taught in Ruth by the fact that there was a near kinsman who said no, is that he has to have the price and he also has to be willing to pay it. And Jesus is all of that. He was our near kinsman. He had the sufficient price to buy us and he was willing. And that's what we've been seeing in the book of John on Sunday mornings. Jesus saying, "No man takes my life from me. I give it willingly. I lay my life down for the sheep." All of that language because he is the one who is close enough to us that he could redeem us and buy us back. So that's why all of that near kinsman and redeemer language is in the Old Testament and where it finds its fruition. And that's all in the book of Ruth, and the book of Ruth is a result of God laying down this rule way ahead of time. So this rule plays into Ruth, which plays into our redemption in Christ. See how the Bible all kind of fits together? When you glean in your fields, you will not reap the harvest of your land, or when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very corner of the field. Neither shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest, nor shall you glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather the fallen fruit of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the needy and for the stranger. I am the Lord your God. You shall not steal, nor deal falsely, nor lie to one another. We're back to the 10. Do you understand my point when I said you really can't divide this chapter up into various categories and say that the law is broken into subcategories? By the way, Kellen, you shall not steal. Which commandment is that? Very good. Roller skates. young people in their rollerblades. Nor deal false, nor lie to one another. Which commandment is that?
Nine.
Because cats lie. And you shall not swear falsely by my name so as to profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. That rule is a rule that gets broken constantly in the world in which we live. It is not only taking the Lord's name in vain. By the way, let's talk about that rule for just a moment. What does it mean to be vain? What is vanity? It's not just empty. It's empty because of what? What is vanity? Yeah, it's all about ourselves, our own vanity, self-conceit and ego, human vanity. So to take the name of the Lord in vain means to employ the name of God for your own self-interest. And people do it constantly when they use God as either a swear word or as an exclamation, or when they would swear by God. Now, Jesus picks this up in his own ministry and tells the Jews, don't swear by God, don't swear by heaven. Let your yea be yea and your no be no. If you're going to do it, say you'll do it and do it, and don't feel the necessity to swear by God. God is bigger than you. You don't control God, and you don't use him as your surety when you make a promise.
Because most of the time you can't keep it.
Most of the time you can't keep it, and then what happens? He says right here, then you profane the name of God. Because you're using God as your surety, and then you and your weakness can't follow through. What did that do to the name of God? And so he says, you shall not swear falsely by my name, so as to profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. You shall not oppress your neighbor, nor rob him. And the wages of a hired man are not to remain with you all night until morning. In other words, if a man works today, you pay him today. You shall not curse a deaf man. Doesn't that seem obvious? If a man can't hear you, you don't stand in front of him saying stuff just because you know he can't hear you. And then he says, and you don't put a stumbling block in front of a blind man. But look at why you don't do it. But you shall revere your God. I am the Lord. That's the same construction as when he said, stand up for an old person and have respect for an old person and revere God. He brings this up repeatedly. These are not just good social etiquette rules. They are really substantial God-honoring rules. You know, it's not just, well, God has given or laid a special burden on these people and therefore don't do it. You don't do it because God said don't do it. And it really falls under the heading of bad idea, just don't do it. And it also comes under the heading of, and I was trying to get there tonight, and I just, if I read really fast, maybe I can get there.
With parents, say, you don't do it because I said so.
Because I said so, but
there's more to it.
It's just wrong.
I know it's getting late, and I know folks need to be somewhere. Can I have 10 minutes, and I can wrap this up?
Yeah.
Because I am trying to get somewhere. But we had to teach you the Ten Commandments, and that took up some time.
But hey, another
Ten Commandments. But hey. You shall do no injustice in your judgment, says verse 15. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbor fairly. These are really all good social rules having to do with dealing in interpersonal relationships. You shall not go about as a slanderer among your people, and you are not to act against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. You shall not hate your fellow countrymen, your other Israelites. Don't hate them in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but you shall not incur sin because of him. In other words, if your neighbor is doing wrong, you can talk to them about it. You can show them where they were wrong. The language is you can reprove them, but don't get angry with them to the point where you hate them. That rule gets carried over into the New Testament. When Jesus says, you've heard it said, thou shalt not kill. But if you hate your brother in your heart, which fellow countrymen, brothers, same concept. If you hate your brother in your heart, you're guilty as a murderer. So Jesus even carried that notion into the Sermon on the Mount. And then you shall surely not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. That's the summary statement of everything we just read. There are all these rules. Be good to this person. Treat people fairly. You can reprove, but don't hate. Don't make a blind man stumble. Don't curse a deaf man. All these good social rules, but then they're summed up in love your neighbor. That love of your neighbor would keep you from wanting to do any harm to them. Now, when Jesus was asked by the Pharisees, turn to the book of Matthew real quickly. Matthew 22. When Jesus was asked by the Pharisees, which is the great commandment? They were expecting one of the ten. They said, okay, there's 10 commandments. Kellen knows all 10 now. So which one is the greatest one? Of those 10, which one is the one that you need to really emphasize above all others? And surprisingly, Jesus did not go to the 10 commandments. In fact, you got it there, Tom?
Yes.
Why don't you read it for us?
Jesus replied, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment.
And then he said, and the second is?
And the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself.
He said, the second commandment. Now think with me, 10 commandments, moral law, unbroken moral law, all of those ideas. He said the second commandment is the second half of verse 18, which says you will love your neighbor as yourself. That's where he went and cited that as the second most important commandment. What does that tell you about the concept of the Ten Commandments as the moral law? Jesus reached outside of those 10 to say which the two great commandments are, and they, that second one, is couched in the context of social rules, civil rules.
He didn't distinguish between the two.
He didn't distinguish in the least between them. So we can't. We can't prefer theological systems over what the Bible actually says. Yeah? Okay. So let's just mark it right there. And we will pick up there at verse 20. Now, if a man lies carnally with a woman. Oh, see, we'll pick up there next week. That'll get you back. All right. So what have we learned tonight? We've learned that it really is impossible. Chapter 19 shows us that it really is impossible to try to subdivide the law into categories. And we've also learned that while the Ten Commandments form the establishment document for the nation of Israel at Mount Sinai, they don't necessarily constitute the unending moral law for all people through all times. Paul certainly tells us that from Adam to Moses there was no law, and says, and where there is no law, you can't break that law. And when you look at chapter 19, the moral and the civil and the ceremonial are intermixed with each other. But they're all really good rules. And so as we continue to look through chapter 19 and through the end of the book, really, we're going to see more of what the mind and the heart of God is. I got an email again this week from somebody saying, you said that 9 of the 10 commandments are recited in the New Testament. And then he asked, where are they recited? And I showed him that the Sabbath was the only one that wasn't. And he wrote back and he said, how is that not essentially legalism then? If you're saying 9 of the 10 commandments are repeated in the New Covenant, how is that not the same as the Old Covenant? Do these rules. Well, it's because of where the rules are positioned in our relationship with God. In the Old Covenant, the rules were the condition on which relationship with God was substantiated. If you do these rules, then you'll continue to have relationship with God where He will bless you and take care of you and take you into your land. If you don't do these rules, God will curse you. If Jesus took the curse of sin for you at Calvary and removed that curse, are you any longer in fear that you're going to fall under the curse of God? Well, no, none of us are worried about that anymore, because not only did Christ take the curse that the law required, He took the law itself, nailed it to his tree, and took it out of the way, so that the handwriting of those ordinances no longer can get us because of their attendant conditional curses. But now that we are saved, now that we are redeemed, now that we are blood-bought, then God can say to us, be holy because I am holy. Be separate because I am separate. Be different than the world. I have chosen you out of the world. And therefore, your response to all these really good ideas and rules is a reaction to the fact that you love God because of how much he has loved you and your effort to be different, to be better, to be separate. But your relationship with him and your salvation is not conditioned on performing the rules. When we fail, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous, who's always there pleading our case, interceding for us. And so no longer is our relationship conditioned on keep rules. It's conditioned on the finished work of Christ. So the law gives us a good view into the heart and the mind of God and what holiness looks like. Israel had to do it conditionally. Nobody could do it, and they ended up under the curse for it. The curse was then paid for in Christ. We are accepted in Christ, and we now perform differently than the world and live differently than the world, and we know what that would look like because of what we can read in the law. But we're no longer responsible to the law in order to be saved. See the difference?
And for the first time, we have the power to do it because we have
only... We have the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, yeah. Which is why also the wonderful news is instead of the 613 laws of the Old Testament... Instead, we see them summarized by Jesus and by Paul as love God and love your neighbor. And Paul says to the Corinthians, all those rules, all those laws, they're summed up in this, love your neighbor. If you love your neighbor, you wouldn't do him any ill. And so all the law is summarized in love God and love your neighbor. But it's summarized all the way back here in Leviticus 19 that way too. Cool, huh? Oh, I saw you do this, and I thought, no? And you said, amazing. And I went, yeah, it is, it is.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.